measure of your intelligence and care. And that's it. I went through it slowly, but once you get the hang of it, we're really talking about a single motion. Noticing, pausing, and then settling back into yourself as you breathe out and the intensity of the urge passes. Pretty soon, you're settling back automatically, metabolizing life's temptations and provocations on the fly. Over time, it's like you live in that settled place more and more, better able to choose what bit of conditioning you want to follow along with. Cheat sheet. 1. Stop. When an urge comes up, notice it and pause instead of hurtling along unheeding. Catching the urge is the hardest part. 2. Understand. Be curious about where this urge lives in your body. Where exactly do you feel this clutch of urgency? In your face, your chest, your hands? Explore for a bit. 3. Relax. Settle back into the urge, breathing out, letting any associated sensations spike and then taper off. Try to let the urge pass through you without either fighting it or acting on it. 4. Freedom. Take a moment to feel satisfaction that you didn't act on the urge. Notice any sensations of the urge dissipating and any other attendant feelings of freedom, openness, and sanity. This noticing with satisfaction will reinforce the surf habit.
Not to nag, but it really is much easier to apply mindfulness in moments of acute stress if you have a foundation of formal practice. Officer Lindsay Fernandez, a 22-year-old rookie, illustrated the point perfectly. When she first started on the job, she had experienced considerable anxiety, especially because she had been assigned to patrol the neighborhood where she grew up, which at times entailed arresting people with whom she'd gone to high school. She had recently started meditating and claimed it had made a big difference. She said, "I'm 5'2". I'm about 110 pounds. I'm a tiny officer. So when I show up to scenes, it's essential that I'm calm, my mind is in the right place, and I'm able to talk to people." She said meditation had made her less scattered and better able to de-escalate situations. For me, it's a big thing, especially when I'm first on the scene being a female. For these officers, keeping a level head was especially important at a time when tensions between police and the community were running high all over America. Officer Dennison Dawson, a jacked but genial patrol cop, weighed in with a surprising take on the subject. He told us, "We see it on some of these videos of confrontations with police, how the officer's interacting with the community. If he was calmer, if he was more caring, it goes a long way." Meditation, said Dawson, could not only help officers reset, but also provide them with more compassion. If you can express that caring and they can see that love coming from you, it's totally a different experience. I was struck by the use of the word love. Playing devil's advocate, I asked whether exhibiting love for people out on the street could hinder your ability to be an effective police officer. "No, it actually increases," he said. "I practice this daily in the community. There's been times when people have cried with me. I've cried with them. I've been vulnerable. I'm able to be intimate and vulnerable with them, even though I have a uniform on." Amplifying the point, Jeff added that meditation helps us see that everyone is caught up in their own baggage. He said, "There are no true enemies. They're just people in screwed up situations." For Officer Dawson, this wisdom was hard-earned. "My mom was a crack cocaine user, never around. All my siblings have different fathers. My father raised me. He was very abusive." As a younger man, Dawson had a lot of anger management issues, a lot of pain. But now, in part through meditation, he had learned how to harness the energy in constructive ways. He said, "You can never completely wipe your past out, but I've learned how to control it and focus it and center it to where it's now my motivation and my drive, not a hindrance." "Wow," said Jeff. "You should be teaching this meditation." Let's not let Jeff off the hook. Here he is with a meditation that plays off a key cultural aspect of police work, skills training. Cops constantly run drills to maintain skills such as shooting and driving. Mental skills are no different. As Jeff explained to the officers, there are 6 mental muscle groups that we train in meditation. We've talked about these skills throughout this book, but here Jeff ties them all together.
My favorite description of the Buddha is the unexcelled trainer of the animal in the human. Meditation practices train the mind, and they train the heart. Sorry, Dan. The core training, the one that sets the stage for all others, is mindfulness. Dan talks about mindfulness as the capacity to notice our stuff. I also like an older definition, to remember. Mindfulness is remembering that we can wake up and smell the coffee at any moment. We can snap out of our trances, and from that place of wider awareness, we can choose both how we want to pay attention and what we want to pay attention to. In this sense, mindfulness isn't neutral. We bring to it a preference for reinforcing healthy patterns and qualities. Our own ethic is built right into it. Other trainings roll out from here. My teacher, Shinzen Young, emphasizes three: concentration, clarity, and equanimity. To these I would add enjoyment and friendliness, because we're trying to help Dan thaw the imaginary block of ice in his ribcage. The baseline levels of all of these qualities can increase over time. As they do, they spill out of our meditations and into our lives. I've already described mindfulness. Here's a quick recap of why each of the other five qualities is important, and what they feel or taste like when they're present in our experience. Concentration. If you've ever felt focused and in the zone, then you know what it's like to be temporarily concentrated. Concentration is the ability to choose and then to hold a direction, to get absorbed in some activity and to see it through. Not only are we more effective when we're concentrated, but there's good science showing that a concentrated mind is a happy mind. Concentration feels like you're merging with the action. It can be very pleasurable, with a slight feeling of internal stillness and quiet. There can also be a slight or strong sense of buffering from the external world. Clarity. This is the ability to discern and then tease apart the details in our actual experience. It balances the dullness that can sometimes happen with concentration, and has other benefits as well, from boosting the vividness of life to giving us better information about our thoughts, our emotions, and our particular patterns of bias and activation. Clarity is clean and bracing, with an aha moment subtle electric snap. It's the satisfaction of seeing an old thing in a new way, or of finding the right focus with your camera so the image is suddenly bright and crisp. It's recognizing what is true in our experience, and for this reason, clarity tastes like sanity. Equanimity. The learned capacity to be smooth with our experience, to not push and pull on sights, sounds, feelings, thoughts, and sensations. Equanimity feels like letting go, like openness, like the world is falling through you. It's the weird and paradoxical skill of getting out of your own way. If you've ever had the experience of being braced against some uncomfortable feeling or sensation, and then suddenly accepting or relaxing into your discomfort, then you've been temporarily equanimous. Usually when this happens, our discomfort diminishes, and some or all of the energy that was bound up in our resistance gets liberated to be reapplied in whatever direction we choose. Service, creativity, medieval jousting. Equanimity is a peerless life skill that has the potential to turn us all into frictionless ninjas. If our first three skills help cultivate a steady and balanced mind, then our next two deliberately skew to the positive. Friendliness and enjoyment are part of the attitude that we bring to meditation. Friendliness. The compassionate part of us that decides to treat all visitors, all thoughts, feelings, sounds, and sensations, with care and good-naturedness. Friendliness is primarily an intention. It doesn't require some big emotion, and in fact, the feel of it will be a bit different for everyone. For myself, it feels like affectionate amusement, like smiling on the inside. Friendliness acts as an insurance policy against subtle inner antagonisms. Enjoyment. Another intention, this time to be open to the hedonic dimension of experience. If friendliness is smiling, then enjoyment is deliberately enjoying the feeling of smiling. Although optional, it does make meditation more pleasurable. The key skill here is balancing enjoyment with equanimity. So finding pleasure in experience without any subtle gripping or dependency. In this meditation, we'll let the mindfulness be implicit and make those other five skills explicit. I'll try to point out each of their tastes in situ, as it were. I can't say enough about how important this is. The single greatest accelerator in a meditation practice is noticing the reward flavor of each of the attentional qualities you're training. So noticing the vaguely enjoyable feeling of being concentrated allows you to get even more concentrated, which in turn increases that enjoyment and concentration and so on. Ditto with clarity and equanimity and friendliness. All of these qualities mutually support and reinforce one another, and all of them feel like something when they're present. Training the mind, a meditation. 10 to 20 minutes. We start with our familiar breath meditation here, the one we've used as the standard through this book. If not the breath, then choose something else you find relatively easy to concentrate on. Maybe some part of the body or sounds. And don't worry if you suck at concentrating. Sometimes I do too. You're simply exploring what it might be like to suck marginally less. It's a training exercise. So take a few minutes to get as focused as you can on your chosen sensation, in a light and good-natured way. We're looking for a balance of concentration and easygoingness. The first skill of concentration is the directedness, the ability to choose what you want to pay attention to. Explore what this is like, to center your attention on a chosen object and then to recenter it every time your mind wanders. Sustained concentration builds quickly in some people and more slowly in others. At a certain point, the mind settles and you get into the zone, or at least more of a zone. It's this feeling of being more in the zone, of being into it, that I want you to try to notice. Sometimes it just feels like the external world has faded a bit and the breath or some other sensation is more vivid and present and full. Other times it feels like there's more quiet inside, more stillness, that it's a tiny bit easier for your attention to stay where you want it. Try to stay relaxed as you proceed. You aren't trying to drill into the sensation. You're just trying to hold your mind lightly in a particular direction. How into it can you get? Can you find something enjoyable in the object of your focus? Although sustained concentration is helpful, concentration also happens in little pulses, pulses of paying attention to something deeply for a moment or two. You can notice that if a more sustained concentration is less available. The instruction is to meditate and be curious about both the experience of directing your attention and any feelings of absorption or intuitness that may emerge. No rush, nowhere to get to, other than easily being with your chosen sensation. Sometimes the stabilization of attention leads to dullness or a loss of vividness. There's less novelty, so we may find ourselves moving towards sleep. We need to actively train ourselves to stay clear once attention settles. Thus, clarity is our next skill. Clarity is the ability to discern the details of our experience. Curiosity is king here. If you're working with the breath, see if you can get very still and steady and notice the most subtle part of it. Can you feel the breath move through your body, through your nose and chest and into the soft rise of the belly? Same goes for sounds, for anything. How fine-grained can you make your sensing? Any kind of noticing is clarity. A couple of things can help. One, stillness. The stiller you are, the clearer the signal. Two, an interest in how sensations move and change from moment to moment. Can you notice things with that level of detail? As usual, if you become aware of other stuff, distractions, thoughts, tensions, see if you can let all that recede into the background. This is part of our next skill, equanimity. Equanimity is lack of interference and uptightness. It's the delicate art of letting everything be what it is, even as you express a light preference via the direction of your focus. Let go of judgments, let go of any bracing or rigidity, let go of all the ways you may be subtly trying to control the experience. Let the sensations and sounds come to you, expressing themselves and moving on. What does it feel like to be receptive in this way? Some people say it feels like lightness, like openness, like maturity. What does equanimity feel like for you? The more you notice the taste of equanimity, the deeper it becomes, in practice and in life. Equanimity is the profound art of accepting the moment. Our last skills are friendliness and enjoyment. Sometimes our meditations can have a stern or serious quality. Notice if that's there and see if you can lighten up a bit. Can you have a slight sense of humor about the experience of breathing or feeling or listening? Where do you feel this subtle friendliness? A trace of a smile at the lips can help. And what about enjoyment? Can you explore this possibility? Noticing the softest part of a sensation, letting it caress you. Finding something enjoyable in just the way you sit. Nothing else to do, just breathing, just listening, enjoying your own company. Moment by moment, recommit to the breath. Feel it as fully as you can. You're building up your mental muscles in an atmosphere of simplicity and easygoingness. Training how you want to exist. When you're almost done, keep your eyes closed and take a few minutes to coast and do nothing. Rest. Then open your eyes. Cheat sheet. 1. Choose an anchor for your attention. Breath, belly, bum, hands. Something in which you already know you can get concentrated. Let yourself get settled and focused. This will be your main meditation object throughout the sit. 2. After a few minutes, notice any subtle feelings of absorption, of being into the breath or sounds. How into it can you get? This into-it feeling is the taste of concentration. If your sustained concentration is weak, you can still notice momentary pulses of being more focused. 3. Get curious about the details of what you're concentrating on. Get as still and stable as you can and try to notice the edges, the center, the individual pixels of the sensation and the way it changes. This pop-out discernment is the taste of clarity. 4. Try to be easygoing about distractions, letting them play out in the background. How open can you be? Smooth, no friction, letting all sensations be there without resistance. This is the taste of equanimity. 5. Finally, see if you can find something enjoyable and even slightly amusing about this whole exercise, smile tugging at your lips. Good-natured about everything, including the breath. These are the tastes of friendliness and enjoyment. 6. When you're ready, let all that go and take a minute or two to just drift. Then open your eyes.
By the time we wrapped up our shoot with the officers in Tempe, all of them seemed to be on board with meditation, even Raj. He said presenting the practice as a training made sense because cops are very good at taking information and retaining information and putting it in a tool bag. We had watched him go from worrying that meditation might dangerously shave down his edge to vowing that he was going to give it a shot. Chapter 8. Blank is my meditation. It was the morning of day 10, the penultimate day of the tour, which would also be our last one on board the bus. We were en route from Tempe to Los Angeles, where we would get around by car instead of our unwieldy orange Leviathan. The remaining hours of the trip took on a sweetly elegiac vibe for me. I was genuinely going to miss this experience. The feeling persisted even when, as I was scavenging through the kitchen area for some breakfast, I discovered a hidden stash of cookies, a whole cabinet filled with all kinds of treats. Literally everyone else on the bus knew about it and had been hiding it from me for more than a week. Fuckers. Other images from these final hours come back to me now like sequences from a cheesy movie montage. Like when we stopped in Palm Springs and found a deserted side road and Eddie pulled out a drone fitted with a camera. We used it to capture some deeply absurd video of me and Jeff striding purposely down the pavement, the bus following behind us. I was picturing a movie trailer with a voiceover artist intoning, "In a world." We were unable to keep straight faces, however, especially when Jeff deliberately walked into me and pushed me out of the shot. Then, once we arrived in L.A., there was the scene that unfolded at a Tony pedestrian mall where we set up the meditation booth one last time. Jeff sensed that I was feeling tight and self-conscious about talking to strangers, so he proposed we do a no-fear practice. That, he explained, is where you decide to adopt the mindset of being utterly unencumbered by any fear or embarrassment. Jeff said he sometimes did this when he went out dancing, an activity that had been in my day planner approximately zero times in the last several decades. In order to show me how it was done, Jeff began hollering, "Free meditation lessons, not crazy." Then he turned to me and said, "Now it's you." I let rip, "Free meditation lessons." It wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. "Woo-hoo," exclaimed Jeff. "Right here, Dan Harris, ABC News. Nice guy." People were still ignoring us, but Jeff was undaunted. "Free meditation. Totally free. Charming fellows. Not a cult." Then he paused. "Maybe a cult." At this point, I was laughing too hard to participate. But the truly standout moment came the next morning on day 11, when Jeff and I were stuck in L.A. traffic in the backseat of a taxi. We were having yet another of our long, rangy talks about life, career, and meditation, when he put his hand on my shoulder and gave me a slightly goofy, utterly earnest look that only Jeff could pull off without being treacly. "I love you, man," he said. Shucks. I told him I loved him right back, and that I could not have imagined a more perfect partner for this trip. And then I tried to figure out whether I was Paul Rudd or Jason Segel in this movie. Throughout these dwindling hours of our road trip, I was able to muster a heightened awareness of my enjoyment of our figurative and literal journey. Occasionally, my mind would go into fast-forward or rewind mode, but I was catching it pretty quickly. I was inhabiting a more gerundial way of being, mindful of the impermanence of it all. I could see clearly how meditation practice enabled this approach and how the experience itself was a sort of meditation. These are the good old days indeed. For me, all of this naturally leads to the following question. Is it possible to milk this kind of enjoyment out of life without meditation? There's a refrain I hear from meditation skeptics quite frequently. "I don't need to meditate. Running or gardening or fill in the blank is my meditation." Jeff and I encountered this sentiment repeatedly throughout our road trip, in fact. A woman in Las Cruces told us that her daily sunrise walk was her meditation. Josh Groban said performing on stage was meditative for him. My answer, whenever anyone asks me whether the aforementioned activities constitute mindfulness meditation, is maybe. It depends on how you do it. For instance, if you go running the way I do, spending most of the time rehearsing elaborate speeches you'd like to hurl at your boss, or listening to music and pretending you're the drummer, it is definitely not mindfulness meditation. If, on the other hand, you're deliberately paying attention to the sensations of your footfalls, the wind on your face, and the movement of your muscles, and then every time you get distracted, you start again, well, then that, to me, is legit. This is not to say that running, gardening, or petting your dog can't be massively beneficial activities. Exercise, for example, not only is good for the body, but also has well-demonstrated antidepressant effects. Bottom line, though, it's not mindfulness meditation unless you are knowingly paying attention to whatever you're doing, and then, when you inevitably get lost, beginning again and again and again. Jeff and I are aware that it is unwise to get overly dogmatic about any one approach to happiness. There are certainly other ways to generate the skills that are honed in meditation. As Jeff says, being open-minded and ecumenical is essential for people in our position. It's what prevents you from getting into that weird salesman thing, he says. Or, as the psychologist Abraham Maslow once said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, you treat everything as if it were a nail. This is a lesson we learned in rather dramatic fashion on the afternoon of the final day. We basically got schooled by a group of formerly incarcerated youth. We had come to Inside Out Writers, IOW, a nonprofit organization that connects Hollywood professionals with minors who have been caught up in the criminal justice system. IOW works with young people both behind bars and after their release, teaching them writing skills as a way to explore and manage their feelings. Jeff and I were hoping to see whether meditation might be of use as well. We were seated in a circle of folding chairs with 11 alumni of the program, all now in their 20s or 30s. The IOW offices are on the second floor of a nondescript building in East Hollywood. The place has a lived-in feel with brown carpets and lima bean green walls, one of which bears the organization's name in spray paint. The alumni, who had been out of prison for varying lengths of time, some of them for serious crimes such as kidnapping and assault with a firearm, used the space as a kind of clubhouse. They come here not only for weekly writing sessions, but also for career advice and social time. The vibe was companionable as the IOWers made get-to-know-you small talk with us, but when Jeff said he was going to lead a Concentration 101 meditation, there was a little bit of apprehension. "So we're going to sit quiet for 15 minutes," one of them said, incredulously. They gamely went along, though, and when it was over, and we all blinked our way back into the room, they were clearly enthusiastic. In fact, some of them revealed that the practice Jeff had just taught was similar to mental strategies they had invented on their own. One young man, Omar Castaneda, who had served 15 years for carjacking, said, "When I was in prison, I would wait until the night, until everything gets shut down, everything gets turned off, my cellmates asleep, and I would meditate, because that would be the only time that I would be able to escape." Things got even more interesting when we began putting pen to paper. At every session at IOW, the group is given a writing prompt. This time, the assignment, inspired by 10% Happier, was to spend 20 minutes describing what they were worried about and whether that worrying was useful. When the time was up, we went around the circle and gave everyone a chance to read what they had written. One of the most moving entries came from Myrel Minor, whose hulking torso was offset by his incongruously doe-like eyes and soft voice. He had grown up in poverty and spent most of his teens and 20s in and out of prison for a series of crimes, including armed robbery. Now, he was hoping to build a career as a screenwriter. "This is called the short list," he said, explaining that he would have written down more of his worries, but "I do not have enough paper for War and Peace." Then he began his litany, which read, in part, "Friends of mine got killed. Family of mine killed themselves. Bills are due. My baby is due, too. My mechanic had to give me a ride here, and I do not have enough money to get back. My sister's rent is due with two kids, and her husband is in a coma. My dad's on his deathbed. My mom's a cancer survivor. Eating healthy is not cheap, so I count penny bank coins, not calories. I am worried that I might let everyone down. I am worried that down might not let me up. But too many paths have led me here to this room, so maybe I have worried enough." Despite the staggering unfairness of his life circumstances, Myrel had a lightness and incandescence about him. The dad in me wanted to wrap the guy up in my arms, although given that he's about three times my size, that would have presented some serious logistical challenges. Myrel explained that he had, by sheer coincidence, recently seen me doing an interview in a documentary film on Netflix called Minimalism. As he told the group, he was like, "Worrying only gets you so far. Once you worry too much, then it becomes unhealthy." And that really struck me. So through all that stuff, all I was going through, my car breaking down, our mechanic really gave us a ride here, all this dying, rent, bills, parole, it was like, I'm only going to take it so far, and then I'm going to just have to let it go. So that's really been helping me get through. And then he added, looking around in disbelief, "After I seen it, I'm sitting in a room with you. It's crazy." "Well," I said, "it's humbling for me to sit in a room with you, because when I listen to you talk, I am reminded that the things I'm worried about are ridiculous." This impression was only further reinforced when it came time to hear from Candace Price, who was wearing a hoodie and bandana and had a searing story to tell. She had been born as a crack baby to a mother with crippling mental illness. She was raised by her grandmother, whose boyfriend sexually abused her. She said, "One of the things that I'm worried about is the fact that my dad just got out of jail after doing 25 years, and I don't know how to love him." Her voice was cracking, her eyes welling up. "It's like, Candace, what are you going to do? Don't treat him like that. He's just trying to love you. But this is all I know. Fuck you. Everybody else left me." She went on to say that she now had many more family members getting out of jail with nowhere to go. so I feel like it's up to me to figure out what to do, she said. And I'm so tempted to go on the streets and get some dope and sell it, but then at the same time I gotta realize that that ain't me. I'm not the person that I used to be, and I'm here for a change. Her reading also included a reference to her roughly 12 suicide attempts, like a box of Dunkin' Donuts, and concluded with this. This shit gets deep, but I want to thank the man above that I was never found in a creek. Candace was greeted by a round of applause from her peers, and then a seemingly effortless outpouring of compassion. They put their arms around her and held forth with words of encouragement and support. Omar told her, "Stop making it your problem. It's our problem." He added, "And as far as your dad and the love goes, just, you don't got to do nothing. Don't feel nothing. Just be. You feel what I'm saying? Just be. Be you, and it's going to come." Myrel chimed in, "You got to love yourself in order to love your dad." I found it incredibly moving to watch Candace take this leap and be caught so lovingly by her friends here in this circle. It was also instructive for me as someone endeavoring to spread the word about mindfulness, because these young people were demonstrating so many of the qualities that can be cultivated through meditation. Listening closely, confronting emotions head on, and living with compassion. They didn't need us. They were doing it already. That is not to say that adding a meditation practice couldn't be beneficial, but clearly the process of writing, which allowed them to view their feelings with some distance, and then the group discussion, which was really a form of group therapy, was taking them a long way. Their talks were like our bus confabs, only closer to the marrow. So while it may not be meditation per se, what these young people were doing through writing and mutual support was most certainly a practice, a deliberate cultivation of mental habits. Per Jeff, a practice is something that you dedicate yourself to and it spills out into the rest of your life in a beneficial way. Playing in a band or on a sports team can teach focus and collaboration. Walking in nature can teach calm and connectivity. Being of service, as my physician father, the non-meditator, has done for decades, can teach compassion. As Jeff said of my father, that's literally called a medical practice. What exactly constitutes a practice? How can the skills of meditation complement and support our current practices? And what's the overlap between meditation, yoga, and prayer? I asked Jeff.
FAQ, practice. I love meditation, but my real passion is understanding what makes people fulfilled. When I meet people who seem present and grounded and content, I'm always curious. How did they get that way? Maybe that's a question only someone who is so not that way for so long would ask. I know some of it is about genes and some of it is about the early stuff that happens when we're kids. But I also know that practice, the various ways we commit ourselves in the time allotted to us, can play a big part. Sometimes these practices are explicit. Prayer, helping, martial arts, etc. But just as often, I think, they're implicit in the way we choose to live. Because that's what humans do, at least the wise ones. They learn. They pay attention. They make adjustments. They make life their practice. What's so cool to me is that many of the skills people figure out at the macro level of their lives are actually the same ones that meditation teaches us at the micro level of the moment. So you see concentration, the ability to hold the direction despite setbacks. Equanimity, the skill of letting go and trusting, of not fighting with everything, of listening to life instead of only our own fixations. Compassion, the practice of caring for ourselves and others, and being skillful about how to act on that caring. And finally, clarity and mindfulness. The practice of looking with discernment at our own responses and habits, and ultimately of finding more perspective. Meditation is like life skills for dummies. I am a supreme dummy. The big picture overwhelms me. It makes me race around like a headless chicken, spewing out explanations and trying to think my way to a neat conclusion, at which point everything will be fine forever. This is not a bad working definition of insanity. The genius of meditation is that it basically says, Hey, relax, bud. All you need to worry about is this moment. Can you find some focus? Some friendliness? A bit of perspective? Yes, I can, meditation. Thank you. And guess what? String together enough moments, you get a life. Go figure.
Okay, let's talk about the moment-to-moment training then. When people say running is my meditation, how can they run in a way that makes this even more true?
Well, it's already a practice in terms of its intention and commitment to improve health, to connect to the body, to nature, and whatever else might be there. You can turbo boost it by deliberately adding some of our meditation skills. How? Start by setting an intention for how long you want to practice the meditation piece. Maybe it's 5 minutes. Maybe it's the whole run. Consider opting out of music or podcasts while you do. Music is obviously fun and can make the run pass more quickly, but the whole point here is not to do this, not to, quote, lose yourself, as Eminem raps in what's obviously the world's most epic running anthem. Rather, you want to try to be fully present with the whole sensory experience. Once you start running, deliberately choose a sensation to focus on. You can choose to stay with one kind of sensation, or you can move your attention around. I do the latter. I start by noticing the feeling of air on my skin. Noting helps. Coolness, or warmth, at a pace that works for you. How sensitively can you feel as you move? When your mind wanders, bring it back. Then a few minutes in, I go inside. So I'll notice the breath in my body, breathing, or the sensations of my feet contacting the ground, touching, or any feelings of streaming energy and exertion through my core, feeling. At a certain point, I shift to notice my whole body moving in space, moving, a giddy, almost vertiginous feeling of being in my center, even as the landscape tracks by. I notice the ambient surround, hearing, as I move inside my bubble of sound, moving, back and forth between outside, hearing, and inside, moving. You get the idea. All this may seem like thinking, and it's true that noting is thinking, but it's minimal, and in the service of the meditation. I actually don't strategize as much as I've suggested here. Generally, I let my attention go where it goes spontaneously. I notice and follow along, trying to get as deep into the feeling and the hearing as I can, even as my thoughts percolate or settle in the background. So that's the mindfulness and the concentration and the clarity. There's also an equanimity piece, where you do your best to maintain a loose and relaxed state in the body as you move. You can be stiff and uncomfortable and still practice equanimity, but the looseness definitely makes a difference. It's amazing how much unnecessary tension we bring to exercise, locomoting like robots, like we're fighting the air around us. The potent combination of equanimity, relaxation, and concentration, combined no doubt with a solid dose of euphoria-inducing endorphins, can create an experience in which all the physical sensations through the core and limbs, breathing, feeling, touching, moving, start to integrate and flow together, flowing. This is an awesome sensation to meditate on, whether you're swimming, running, biking, or doing any endurance sport. Athletes say this quality can extend into our relationship with the world around us. We can enter a kind of flow state or zone where, if we're focused and quiet enough on the inside, we find we're able to respond more effortlessly to changing circumstances on the outside. The experience is exquisite, even mystical, and actually what Eminem is probably pointing to in his song. One sports psychologist told me you can't really teach this kind of high-level flow. You can only prepare the conditions for it to happen. We do this by being both well-trained in our sport and by cultivating exactly the mindfulness skill set I just described.
What about other practices like yoga and tai chi that many people feel are inherently meditative? I get a ton of questions about these.
Yeah, me too. Well, yoga is a rich and comprehensive system of practice, as are the many schools of Taoism from which tai chi emerged. Both contain meditation techniques outside the postures, and both have figured out ways of integrating meditative principles into the postures. So to focus just on the physical side, both practices center around the insight that a vital, open, and well-aligned body helps create the conditions for a vital, open, and well-aligned mind. Practitioners yoke their attention to the breath and to the physical sensations of energy and movement, and in so doing, they find that everything starts to move more easily. You can actually apply mindfulness and other skills to either of these practices in exactly the way I've described in the running section. In fact, mindfulness is implicit in the way both are often taught, which is about tracking what's happening in the body and generally increasing our awareness of our visceral body-based feelings. The equanimity piece is particularly clear. In both Tai Chi and yoga, practitioners are encouraged to move smoothly and fluidly, to be on the lookout for ways in which the body might be subtly fighting with itself. So in yoga, you notice where in your body you're blocked or holding tension, and then you breathe into those sensations, deliberately and systematically relaxing the areas around them. You try to find composure in the posture, even as you're shaking with exertion. The idea is that if you can find equanimity and balance under these strained and artificial conditions, then you can find it in the office, or at home, or on the street, when you're not all twisted around like a reef knot. So the skills naturally radiate out into life.
Here's a biggie. How about the connection between prayer and meditation?
Huge question. It depends on the kind of meditation and the kind of prayer. The heart of prayer is humility and equanimity. It's not pretending your limited perspective is capable of figuring everything out. It involves the belief that sometimes the right move is to trust and to surrender to both the flow and the source of life. This emerges naturally in meditation. Additionally, many people get very concentrated in prayer. They get still and quiet, and this allows them to reset. And of course, in all the Abrahamic traditions, you have a huge emphasis on compassion and service, the living practice of this. So many of the skills are there. The main difference is probably the feeling of being in relationship. Folks who pray aren't sitting alone with their stuff, but sharing it with a wise and loving other whom they can ask for guidance. I think mindfulness can be a helpful adjunct to prayer. It can help improve people's focus, so they're less likely to get lost in discursive thought, for one. It also helps generate insight into how we are, into our various patterns and blind spots and biases.
In your view, does meditation conflict with faith?
I'm not really sure how it would, especially the secular approaches to mindfulness, which present all of this very much as mental and emotional skills that anyone can benefit from, regardless of the nature of their particular existential belief wrappers. Personally, I think it can enhance the beautiful qualities of faith I've already described, the humility, the joy, the love, and it might temper some of the more shadowy aspects that can emerge around doctrinal rigidity and intolerance. Although these are human challenges that go beyond the faith-based religions. I'm going to shift gears now. Let's look at something that many people consider meditative, walking, and see how we might inject a big dose of mindfulness into the activity. Actually, this is a twofer. I'll show you how to turn any walk into a meditation, and also how to do a more formal version. Formal walking meditation is an excellent alternative to seated practice, and a big part of both my meditation life and Dan's. Sometimes it's the only practice you want to do. Sitting feels too agitating, or you don't feel like meditatively working with your emotions. A walking practice at these times can be a huge relief, both grounding and refreshing. Walking, a meditation. Option one, formal. 5 minutes or more. Choose your field of operation. It can be a small inside space cleared of obstacles or a circumscribed outside area. Decide. Shoes on or off. Get curious about how completely you can stay with the physical sensation of moving and how unhurried and deliberate you can make each step. The classic meditative focus points are the 2 feet. So take your first step slow and note lift as the foot lifts, aware of the release. Move as it glides forward, aware of the slightly unstable swing through space, and then step as it lands, aware of the miniature recalibrations of balance and pressure. And then do the same with the next foot. And so it goes, 1 foot after the other, a frankly weird and ungainly bipedal spectacle whose automaticity you are doing your very best to undo. What is walking? What is this new tingling, walking, feeling situation? Have a good time. Recruit your imagination. You're allowed to do this in meditation. Walk on the earth like you're Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, testing the gravity, pretending you don't know what's coming. Can you notice the little differences in each step? Can you be that clear and focused? Slow it down. No rush. Here for the act of it, each step landing in the here and now. Lift, move, step. If your feet are bare, try sampling the textures beneath you, the bent grass or smooth floor, the bumps and depressions, each foot probing and feeling like a long, downturned hand, to quote my pal, the eco-philosopher David Abram. If emotions and thoughts intrude, as they will, just redirect to physical sensations, scooping out the body with your mindfulness. If you're outside, from time to time, look up and check out the size of life, the trees, the buildings, sky, sky, sky. Listen to the birdie birds go chirp, chirp, chirp. Feel the breeze. Lick a random forest mushroom. No, don't do that. Life is all around, and you're aware and alive and walking in peace. Option 2, informal. 30 seconds to ultra-marathon length. So our inner world of thoughts and feelings can exert a very powerful gravity. This practice is one way to balance this, by shifting attention to the body and the world's actual gravitational pull. Start by noticing the feeling of your legs moving and your muscles working as you walk. Notice your swinging arms, but also your core, this center line that moves with you, the world reorganizing itself in your peripheral vision. Space parting in front and closing behind. Notice the air on your skin, the weather on your face, the solidity of the land against the soles of your feet. Choose how wide or how narrow you want your focus, and whether you want to stay with one type of sensation or move your attention around. Both options are fine. See how totally you can commit to feeling your body move this way. Some people like to walk slowly. I like to walk fast. I like to lope forward in long strides, the ground reaching up to catch each foot like I'm a giant striding across a continuously forming island volcano chain. Experiment. Practice walking playfully, joyfully. Set this as your experimental intention. What is it like to walk joyfully? Well, I don't believe I know. Let me attempt this unusual exercise. And so you do. Newborn in your new skin in this newfound moment. How does it change the feeling, the action? Can you walk as an offering to Zeus, to the city's surveillance cameras, to our would-be extraterrestrial conquistadors? Show reality what it's like to be a happy human turning the planet with your measured stride. Or slow it right down and keep it simple. As you walk home from work, as you cut across the park, the formal practice remembers itself. Lift, move, step. Lift, move, step. Just this moment, uncoupled from lists and schedules. Lift, move, step. Lift, move, step. Grateful to be here. Intimate or expansive, make this meditation your own. Cheat sheet. Option 1, formal. Choose inside or out, some circumscribed area you can move comfortably in. Shoes on or off. Set the intention to move slowly and deliberately. 2. Bring your attention to your 2 feet. Take your first step and note lift as the foot lifts, move as it glides forward, step as it lands. Then repeat with the next foot. 3. Enjoy the simplicity. Be curious and clear and wonderstruck by the weirdness of it all. If emotions and thoughts intrude, redirect to physical sensations. Finish when you finish. Option 2, informal. 1. Wherever you are, notice your body as you walk. See how totally you can commit to the feeling of your body moving. 2. Experiment. Practice walking joyfully. Set this as your intention. How does it change the feeling, the action? Or slow it down and keep it simple.
To sum up here, any practice in which you are currently engaged can be infused with greater degrees of intentionality and mindfulness, to say nothing of the other skills we've been exploring. One essential and challenging aspect to any practice, though, is consistency, and that is the final obstacle we will tackle. Chapter 9, I Can't Keep It Going. In many ways, Wanderlust Hollywood embodies everything I've made it my business to mock. It's a giant, slick yoga studio and community center near Sunset Boulevard that serves Ayurvedic stewed mung beans in its cafe and offers classes with names like Soul Revival, Energetic Alignment, and Yin Breathe Chillax. But the company, which also produces yoga festivals across the world and creates instructional content, operates in a refreshingly cool and unpretentious manner. Furthermore, I had gotten to know and like the CEO, Jeff Krasno, a wry, sharp businessman who gave us insightful advice about our 10% happier startup. So when the folks at Wanderlust offered to host the final event of our road trip in their giant yoga hall, which they modestly refer to as the greatest place, how could we refuse? I had been worrying, as is my wont, that no one would show up, but we got several hundred people to come out on a Wednesday night and join us in the cavernous room. Eddie had spent the previous 24 hours scrambling to edit together a series of highlights from our road trip, which we played to the audience. As I watched some of the best clips with Paula Ferris, Josh Groban, and Sergeant Raj Johnson projected onto the hall's big screen, I was already nostalgic. I was also relieved when I spotted the elusive Moby slip into the room and take a seat in the back row waiting to be called to the stage. Unlike some of the people we had met over the course of our journey, the crowd in L.A. did not have much ambivalence about mindfulness. They lived in a city teeming with vegan restaurants, Pilates studios, and grown men and women who are paid millions of dollars to pretend to be superheroes in movies. Comparatively, meditation did not seem so weird. Here, a different concern emerged. How to keep the practice going? A woman in the back raised her hand to say that she had gone on several streaks of daily meditation, but had been unable to establish a regular habit. She asked, "How can I anchor into something consistent that doesn't end after 7 days?" Since we're about to release you into the wild as a fledgling meditator, let's go back into life hack mode with 9 more pro tips that might help you commit to a regular practice. Pro tip: cut yourself some slack. The first thing I told the woman in the back of the hall was that the consistency issue is incredibly common, and the most important thing is to give yourself a break. Jeff echoed this sentiment, pointing out that there will inevitably be times when you fall off the wagon and that the key is to realize that this is a pattern that lots of people are in. When people falter at meditation or at any new habit, they tend to blame their lack of willpower. They tell themselves a story about how hopelessly undisciplined they are, which only makes them less likely to try again. As we've discussed, the maddeningly ephemeral inner resource of willpower may be one of the most insidious fallacies in behavior change. In the face of a setback, instead of engaging in self-laceration, the vastly superior option is our sappy old friend, self-compassion. Studies suggest that rather than making you smug, self-compassion can help you withstand daily indignities such as failure, rejection, and embarrassment. People with this attribute have a greater willingness to learn from and correct their perceived weaknesses or mistakes, which boosts resiliency, making them better able to get back into the fray. Pro tip: just begin again. No matter how long it has been since you last meditated, no matter how mindlessly you have behaved in the interim, nothing has been lost. You can always just start over. It's just like when you get distracted during meditation itself. The game is to good-naturedly begin again ad infinitum. The best way to approach establishing a meditation habit, or again any habit, is with a spirit of experimentation. Don't expect to install a meditation practice into your life like a piece of software and never look back. You should view failures as an inevitable and even healthy part of the process. When you tumble off the wagon, just reevaluate the plan and come up with a new one. As Thomas Edison, himself no stranger to laboratory experimentation, is reputed to have said, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Remember, different tactics work for different people at different times. You should feel free to explore, to tinker with ways to let the benefits of meditation hook you, rather than attempting to gut it out through sheer willpower. Pro tip: set realistic, achievable goals. A young woman in the front row at Wanderlust told us that she was balancing her full-time job, a three-hour commute, and three little kids at home. For a while, she had managed to fit in 20 minutes of meditation a day on top of all of that, but eventually she said, "I just stopped because I couldn't do it." Then a friend recommended she try sitting for just 5 minutes a day. As she told us, "I found that out of the last 35 days, I think I've sat 32, and I feel amazing on just 5 minutes." Bingo. "You don't need to have such ambitious goals," I replied, "if the math doesn't work out." As you test ways to boot up a regular practice, it is best to set sustainable targets. My friend Richie Davidson, one of the leading neuroscientists studying the impact of meditation on human health and behavior, poses an interesting question when enrolling new subjects for his studies. He asks, "How much time do you think you can actually practice and do it every day?" Some people choose just 60 seconds, which Richie says is good enough to gain enrollment. Personally, I've seen so many friends get excited about meditation and declare their intention to sit for significant periods of time every day, only to hit the rocky shoals of disappointment and self-recrimination. True, lowering your sights can be frustrating if you feel your contemplative ambitions are being stifled. However, while meditation almost certainly confers more benefits the more you do it, there's no point in setting goals you can't achieve. As Jeff told the woman in the front row at Wanderlust, we have to accept that we go through periods of our life where we're just not going to have a lot of time to practice. The move, he said, is simply to acknowledge that this is your life right now. He added an important point, though. If you are only able to practice for a few minutes, there are ways to amplify your practice by injecting micro hits of mindfulness throughout your day, as Jeff suggested back in Chapter 3. This kind of free-range meditation can absolutely help get the habit more deeply ingrained in your life and boost the odds of consistency over time. Our first guest of the evening had an interesting take on the dosage question. We invited to the stage Bill Duane, the superintendent of well-being at Google. Bill's job is to develop and run programs that help employees advance happiness and effectiveness in the workplace. He's a jolly guy who, with his long, graying beard and earlobe discs, looks like a fourth rave-inflected member of ZZ Top. An engineer and an atheist, Bill had come to meditation warily. As he told the crowd, "My methods of dealing with stress were along the ancient wisdom traditions of bourbon and cheeseburgers." But the stresses of his work life, compounded by the death of his father, threw him into a tailspin. That's when he happened to attend a lecture at Google about the neuroscience of emotion, in which he learned that you can change your brain through meditation. He took a deep dive, attending more than a dozen long, silent retreats, which he believed drastically improved his life. When he began promoting the practice at Google, his initial inclination was to recommend that people engage in significant amounts of formal daily sitting. His colleagues ultimately pushed back, telling him there needed to be a slower buildup. So now, to help people get over the hump, he instructs them to meditate in manageable 5 to 10 minute segments, and sometimes even smaller. Like us, Bill had come to the conclusion that 1 minute counts. As he told the crowd, "Google is full of high achievers, and if we set our minds to do something and then we don't do it, we have a tendency to meet that with a fair amount of self-criticism. Imagine if someone gave you a device and they said, 'If you use this device, you will be happier and more effective and more compassionate.' And then the first thing you do is you start hitting yourself over the head with the device." Pro tip: continually re-up your motivation. When you're doing it all by yourself, meditation can start to feel a little stale. It's easy to lose touch with why you're putting yourself through it in the first place. Both Jeff and I have found that merely glancing at a few pages of a good book on meditation can have an enlivening effect. We'll make a few specific suggestions later in this audiobook. My bedside table and bookshelves are stacked with dog-eared, note-filled volumes. I try to read a few pages every single day. It makes me realize why so many Christians have well-worn Bibles around the house. As Jeff has said, one definition of the word mindfulness is remembering. Every time you glance at a good book, it helps you recollect and reconnect. Additionally, most teachers have online videos, podcast interviews, and guided meditations that you can check out.